Thank you, Alex. That was great. I'm Rachel Barnett. I'm president of Jewish Historical Society, and it is our pleasure to be here in Florence to celebrate with all of you. I remember Rabbi Volb, actually, very well, because I was part of TYG, as I wrote in my note to the in the newsletter. But we lost our rabbi in Sumter about that time, and those of us that were to be confirmed that year would come over to Florence, and we joined the confirmation class over here. So I have my own memories of the synagogue very well. So we're going to move along now with our next panel, and I'm going to introduce our moderator. And we'll take a short break after that panel in between, okay? So I guess we would like our panelists, if they would, to start making their way up to the front. And we'll get set. All right? It'll be painless. Yes. Yeah, be careful of those. All right. Joseph Rubenstein, recently retired from Coker College, where he taught courses in mathematics and science education, and one course titled Teaching the Holocaust. He lives in Hartsville with his wife, Heike. They have two grown children and three grandchildren. After studying in San Diego, his son returned to South Carolina, where he has a faculty position at MUSC. Dr. Rubenstein will moderate the panel, and we will get started. PD Pioneers. Thank you.
Thank you. We're going to have a discussion about the...
Please use the mics.
I'm sorry.
With me on the panel are four representatives of businesses that had their origin in the PD area. And we're going to have a discussion about some of those businesses, how they started, where they are now, if they're here at all, and some of the relationships that the business proprietors had with the general population of the PD, that is Jewish-Gentile relations, perhaps Jewish-Black relations. But before we go further, I'm going to ask the panelists to introduce themselves very briefly, because then we'll end up with a discussion between all of us. So we'll start over here with Richard Weintraub, and I'll allow him to introduce himself and the business that he represented.
I'm Richard Weintraub. I live in Durham, North Carolina now, but I was born in Florence, and the same year I was born, my father started his business, which was Larry's Department Store, my father and my mother. He had come after the war to work with his uncle as a traveling salesman, met my mother, got married, and worked elsewhere, but then came here in 51 and ended up building, I think it was 8 stores in 7 towns in the PD. He and my mother and I worked in the store, my sister worked in the store, but I ended up going to law school and moving on away.
We didn't plan it this way, but on my left are those folks who were retail business people, and on my right are those who were manufacturers. But we'll finish with the introductions with Donna next.
Yes. I'm Donna Cohen. I'm the granddaughter of Isidore Cohen, who was a peddler who came to the United States around the turn of the century, made his way to Baltimore, and found brothers that came with him on the ship who helped sponsor him, gave him money to get him as far as Latta. To my mother's regret, he didn't have enough money to get to Florence. So Izzy traveled the countryside for many years and went to work for one of the other Jewish merchant families that was in Latta, the Blum family. And he eventually left there, went to open his own business, which he operated until my father came back from the war, and became I. Cohen and Son. My dad and my mother operated the store until the mid-1980s, when they decided to retire and move to Florence.
And we're going to find out later how three Jewish department stores ended up in this little town of Latta. Are we? Right. You going to tell us about that later?
I'm going to tell you about that. There were four at one time as well.
Excuse me, four.
Imagine that, on Main Street in Latta.
Now we'll hear from the manufacturing side of the PD pioneers. Rick, you want to go first?
No.
Bruce, go first?
I'm saving myself for last.
Okay.
I'm Bruce Siegel. We have a history in manufacturing on our family that dates back to 1905 when my grandfather Adam came over from Poland. And my son is sitting over there today who has the same name as his great-grandfather Adam. And we have a wonderful history, which I can expand upon perhaps a little bit later on when Joe gives me the signal. But we've been in the lighting business for many, many years. My father moved down in 1963, and we brought some really unique types of manufacturing to the PD area as being the first and only light bulb company in the country that set up shop in the Carolinas. And we manufactured until probably well into the 80s when things changed and business changed a whole lot, as Rick would know about his business. Anyway, I'll pass it on to Rick, and we'll come back with some stories later.
Rick?
Okay, I'm Rick Levy from Marion. We didn't come from Baltimore or New York. We came from Mississippi. you could tell that by my accent. We were right outside of Pascagoula, Mississippi. My father was working at a company that was called BVD. They used to make underwear and sweaters. The sweaters that they made were for the U.S. Postal Service. It was those navy wool heavy sweaters that the postal workers. Well, the company down there decided they were going to close the sweater division. My father was a vice president in charge of manufacturing down there. And he asked them, instead of junking the machines, could he buy them? And they said, well, we need the space. You've got less than a month to move them out, but you could have them very, very cheap. And father agreed on the price and all that stuff. So now he needed a place to go. Well, he in turn was familiar with the Carolinas. Back before, I guess before the Big Depression, he went to Catawba College. He wanted to be a doctor. He wanted to go to Duke. But Duke at that time wasn't taking any Jews. But someone told him if he goes to a North Carolina junior college, make good grades, he could transfer to Duke. So he was down at Catawba College, and then Depression hit. So he went back to New York. And anyway, he ended up in Mississippi. When he was down there, and he was checking in the Carolinas, he wrote the Chamber of Commerce in, this might be a little longer than you want, but in North and South Carolina.
I've got a hook.
Okay. Right. North and South Carolina. I'll try to talk fast. So South Carolina Chamber of Commerce said that there's a plant available in Marion, South Carolina. Hasn't been used since the war. This is in 1952. So my father flew up, met a fellow named Tom Hunter in Marion, showed him this old Mason knitting netting company. Every window in the building was broken. There was pigeons flying through the place. The floor was rotted out, a wooden floor. And the road around the plant had these hills where valleys that I think kids were riding around or something. I mean, the place was nothing. But this guy, Tom Hunter, said, if you want this building, I could have it ready in 2 weeks, maybe three at max. And father took a liking to him. He took a liking to my father. Father said, okay. And all legal thing they did, they shook hands. Father said, in 3 weeks, we're going to have the trucks bringing the stuff in. And father left, loaded up the trucks, not even knowing if this guy was going to have the building ready. He just met him. Well, this guy, Tom Hunter, ended up hiring about 200 workers, and he had the building almost usable when we got there. Well, over the years we expanded and whatnot, but I'll tell you the rest later. We ended up, sweaters and knit shirts, and then we went to ladies' wear, and I'll explain all that in a few minutes. Oh, the BVD company stayed down there, and then they closed and went back up to Philadelphia. Next to myself, I like BVD best.
I used to buy BVD underwear. That's right. I don't see it in the stores anymore, though.
They also made Captain Had a Call shirts.
Okay. We're going to go in a little bit now to the history of some of these businesses, but I'm going to ask each of the panelists to speak whenever they feel like it and to couch what they say in terms of what the contribution of these businesses was to the social life, to the economy, to the well-being of the PD area of South Carolina. So talk a little bit about the history and talk amongst yourselves, but what was the contribution to the well-being of the PD area in terms of interpersonal relations, in terms of social justice, in terms of whatever you want to talk about? Who wants to go first?
I'll go first. Okay.
I thought so. Okay.
I'm not used to talking among a big crowd like this. Okay. Over the years, Heritage, it was Herbert Mills that was named after my father, Herbert. And in 1968, he had a partner, Carrie Borsham out of Charlotte, decided to sell to a big corporation, which was then Wayne Gossard. They made Gossard lingerie, Gossard nylon stockings and stuff like that out of Chicago, and then they end up moving to Chattanooga. But they said the only way they would buy Heritage Sportswear, that my father would stay on and run it, but not run it just with them leading. He said, we're going to just turn you loose. You do what you want. It's your company. And so my father and my older brother worked with him, and they got up to about 700 people. They made sweaters, knit shirts, and then in 84, they saw the handwriting on the wall, and they went to ladies' designer clothes. They made the Joan Vass line, and it had quite a few good years. In 1999, before that, when they were growing, in the late 50s, early 60s, they started training blacks in a pretty healthy way. In fact, they opened up a small plant in Marion called Opportunities Incorporated to train the blacks to then move over to the main plant. From the first day they opened the plant, in 52, my father said, we're only going to have one water cooler in the plant for the whites or the blacks. And whoever wants to drink, if you don't want to drink out of it, don't. They only had one bathroom. They didn't have any signs there said colored or anything like that. And I think the people realized that my father being Jewish, he considered everybody equal. And that's the way we were brought up. But in 1999, they decided that the main corporation, that they were going to become marketing and move everything overseas and close all the plants. And they had about 8 or 9 plants. NAFTA had killed it, and then 9/11 has killed business and whatnot, lifetime in 2001. But we were down to about 300 people. My brother and I decided that if we let them close the plant, there's going to be 300 people out of work, and there was no jobs available in the PD area. So we bought the company, and we fought to try to keep it open, and we finally had to close it in 2005. And the biggest problems was NAFTA, 9/11, and China. China will knock off anything that's good and sell it a lot cheaper. But anyway, so that's a little bit of the story.
And so from what I hear, to summarize, your contribution, your company's contribution to the PD was in the area of giving much employment and in the area of social justice for blacks.
Correct.
Let me go on to the other side now. Thank you. And yes, Mr. Weintraub, Richard, if he can add something to that contribution your business has made to the PD, perhaps in the areas that Rick spoke about, perhaps in other areas.
Well, of course, they provided employment to people with not high skill generally, although the managers had quite a bit of ability. Oh, is it not working?
It fixes for now.
I thought you fixed it.
Yeah, we're working on it.
I have faith. How's this? Yes, I can tell. In relations between blacks and Jews, I mentioned in the article that's in the publication that some of you may have read that I think my dad was the first white employer in Timmonsville, where he had his main store, to hire an African American to work inside the store as a salesperson. That was a woman, and he, kind of odd that, I mean, people have such strange beliefs about race. At first, the black saleswoman used the men's room that my dad and I used and the other white men used. And then I think just at some point, it's kind of sad though, but I mean, people work that way. But at some point, she just drifted over because I think the white sales ladies just realized, you know, she's just another person. I'm kind of cracking up here, but it's. But other than that, I think the relation we ended up. I'm telling the article as well. You can get a little more detail there. That my dad also started hiring black teenagers to work in the warehouse. Well, that was physical labor, and I don't think anybody thought much of that. But he also tried to kind of sneak them in to work in the store as salespeople. And they became accepted, too. So it was just kind of a little corner of the world that in the early and mid-60s was not such a nice place for blacks in the Carolinas. But kind of did his part.
Thank you, Richard.
I don't know why it's about.
And that, I know. Question. Would you like to come up here?
When I first came to town in 1982, I took a class with Dr. Larry Jordan at Francis Marion, and he was a world-renowned potter at that point. And he told me that as a young teenage boy who really loved learning, that Larry's father, that Richard's father and mother, hired him to go and get coffee and sandwiches at lunchtime for their employees. And they not only paid him, but they asked him, what would you really like most in the world? And he said, well, I love to read books, and I can't go to the Florence Library. And he would make a list of books that he wanted to read that his school teachers had told him about. And Larry and Sylvia would go to the library and take them for him. And he never forgot that kindness. And he used to drop in and see them when he came back as a successful academician. So I just wanted Richard to know that.
Thank you. And now Donna is going to tell us a little bit about the four businesses in Latta and the contribution that her business and these businesses made to the Latta community and to the greater PD community.
Well, of those businesses, Cohen's department store was more of a general store. We sold tobacco cloth, and someone asked me today what that was, and I said, we didn't have to know what it was used for. We just had to sell it. So we had all kinds of things in that store that I wasn't sure what they were for. We sold fabric and linoleum and clothing and shoes. But one of the things that I always remember that goes to the topic of social justice is that my grandfather extended credit to sharecroppers. And some of those people were blacks. And I don't know about the other businesses in town, but my guess is that they were not allowed to come in and buy things. I know Kornblutz did this, however, to buy things, and then when the crops came in, they were back to pay for things. There were several white sharecroppers I know that would come in and buy something for their families every single Saturday. One Saturday on credit and the next Saturday to pay, just to exercise that privilege of being able to charge something. I am kind of guessing that maybe my grandfather, who grew up, he was 15 when he left what was some part of Russia then that became Lithuania, that his growing up times were very agrarian, and so he probably had some bonding thought with these people because that was his initial heritage. And for many years, Cohen's was the place where black people knew that they could come in and get things for church or for a funeral or for whatever the important occasion was. And if you didn't have the money that day, you could still take it home. So that was a social contribution. I know from growing up, many families had maids, and we were one of those. And someone from the community got very angry with my mother once because she said that you were paying your maid more than any of the other maids got paid, and that created a problem for the ladies in town because they had to then pay more. On the topic of the businesses in Latta, my grandfather Izzy went from being a peddler to working in Blum's department store. And Blum's was, I think, the largest store in town. And Izzy parted company with Blum's because one day the wealthiest man in Latta came in and said, "Izzy, you sold me these shoes 2 weeks ago. Look at them, the sole is coming off." And my grandfather was so mortified that he says, "My goodness, here, take another pair of shoes, I'm so sorry." And when Mr. Blum came back to the store that afternoon, my grandfather shared with him his concern about the quality of the shoes they were selling. And Mr. Blum fired him on the spot and said, "Izzy, you gave away my money. You can't do that." So that is what prompted Izzy to go start his own store. And he was sponsored by something called the Baltimore Mercantile Company. And companies in Baltimore and in the Northeast were interested in becoming shareholders, if you will, stakeholders with Jewish men who were just itinerant salesmen, basically, in getting them started. So I have in my possession the original paperwork where they gave him, in 1923, $8,500 worth of merchandise to stock his store, which my brother calculated one day when we found this paperwork, that would have been like $150,000 worth of merchandise in today's dollars. So that is how Izzy got his start with his store.
Thank you, Donna.
You're welcome.
And now we'll hear from Rick Levy.
No.
Bruce Levy, I'm sorry. No.
Bruce Siegel. Rick's had his turn.
I'm sorry. I know Bruce.
He's in sweaters. I was
know
in lighting.
Yeah. We'll hear from Bruce about...
Let me give you a little bit of history on manufacturing light bulbs. Back in 1905, when my grandfather came over from Poland, he couldn't speak English. He was about 18 years old, and he took a job with what was known as the Edison Electric Factory in Kearny, New Jersey. And that was the forerunner of GE's lighting factory. And he worked on the equipment making light bulbs. Well, he worked at it long enough that in 1932, he and a few other partners that he found started a company called Marvell Lamp Company. And you might wonder how an independent lighting company can survive amongst the giants in those days, which was General Electric and Phillips, or, well, at that time it was Westinghouse and Sylvania. My grandfather came up with a new idea, and that was to make incandescent light bulbs that can last 2,000, 5,000, and 10,000 hours. The major companies wanted the bulbs to burn out. They lasted for 750 hours. My grandfather designed the initial long-life light bulbs, and he then set up a factory to provide these products. My father and his brother joined my grandfather back in the late 50s, the early 50s, though, and they were located in Hoboken, New Jersey. And if you've watched television recently, you saw where Hoboken's completely flooded out. The building that they were in is like right around the corner from the Holland Tunnel. That's underwater. They also had their sales office on River Street, which is right where the river came up, and that's all flooded today. But back in the early 60s, they realized they were starting to really grow the business, and it started to become pretty successful. So my uncle, who was in charge of administration, told my father we needed to find a new factory. And they were reading the Wall Street Journal one day, and they saw an ad for a 100,000-square-foot building with rail siding in Mullen, South Carolina. And my uncle said to my father, well, Arthur, if you're going to move the factory out of Hoboken, you and your wife are going to have to go to South Carolina. He says, I'm staying here in New Jersey. I don't go to South Carolina. My father said, you don't need to worry about a thing. My wife goes wherever I want to go. And Arthur got on a plane, came down here with my mom, and looked around at the factory, called his brother up and said, we can move the factory. This place is phenomenal. And they actually made a deal with the owner of the building, a fellow by the name of Dolph Overton, who was a Korean War pilot, and he was an ace. He was very well known in the community. But it was his building, and they made a deal with him. My father and his brother didn't realize how much the community wanted to entice manufacturers from up north to come down. So by trying to make a deal with the owner of the building, they almost lost out on all the benefits that the state of South Carolina would provide to new industry if you packed up and moved to South Carolina. And I remember my father and my uncle took me with them, and I was just a young fellow. I was still going to school at NYU. And we went to the governor's office in Columbia. And at that time, Donald Russell was the governor. And they offered us the moon to move that factory down. And it was quite an experience. And we turned around, worked with the county officials in Mullins. And one of the primary deals of moving the factory was that my father promised he would hire black people. There were no factories really in the community. Of course, you had some black help, but there was no manufacturing facilities of our type that wasn't involved in textiles that would hire blacks. We made a pledge. It was 1963 in May, and my dad said he was coming down, and it's really unique because my wife, Connie, found all the old newspaper articles in her office, and I was reading through them the other day, and it's written right in the articles that Arthur Siegel's moving the factory and they're going to employ Negro people. And, you know, today you don't think about saying things like that, but that was a very historic thing in the relationship between a Jewish family moving south and the relationship with the black community. And there were a number of instances where some of the whites were not real happy because we were putting black labor into a factory and paying them a minimum wage where they had been working household jobs, you might say, or picking tobacco in the fields and making pennies per hour back in those days. And my father said that he would have the factory up and running inside of a few months, and I found an article in the newspaper that my wife provided. On October 22nd, 1963, the first light bulbs came off the production line. And October 22nd is really a historic day because that was my parents' anniversary. And so it really, I was so happy to read that because I didn't remember it. And it really, my parents spent a lot of very, very wonderful years down here and was so excited about the things that happened here at the temple. The picture you saw in 1969 when they broke ground, again, I was just about 22 years old, 23 years old, and I was standing out front when they did that. And we have so many fond memories of the things that transpired. But the contribution that we made was significant in the PD community. At our peak, we had over 400 people working around the clock. We made in excess of 2 million light bulbs a day. And it really was fantastic. We operated that way until the family decided to sell the business in 1974 to a large conglomerate called American Brands. You've heard of American Tobacco. They bought us, and within a few years, they decided it wasn't really their cup of tea. But my father waited out 5 years. He wasn't allowed to go back in business. And at the end of 5 years, we moved one block up the street from his old factory, and we started a new company called Supreme Lighting. And we, again, grew that business into a very substantial-sized light bulb company, and we bought our old company back from American Brands. So we did have a historic significance in Mullins, and it's just so unfortunate that, as Rick alluded, China became so prevalent in lighting, importing products, and we just couldn't continue manufacturing, and we did sell the business. I think it was 19, we sold again to another large company, and I think it was about 1980 or so, no, 90, 1990, and they promised all new equipment for us, everything was going to remain just great, we were going to grow the business, and within about 6 months, they said, no, you got to close the factory. We're going to import the products from all around the world. And so where once there was over 400 people working 24 hours a day, Mullins today, it's a ghost town. There's an empty building, and there's nothing going on there. It's really a shame. But the Jewish relationship within the community was outstanding. We were well thought of, as were the Levies. We always participated in numerous events together. And I think we were very well received. Still get a lot of nice notes from people who used to work for us.
Thank you, Bruce. And I do know your name. Before I move on to a little bit about the social life of Jewish people and Jewish businesses in the Bible Belt, I just want to make sure that I finish speaking about your businesses. So do you have anything else to say about your businesses? We move on.
Of course, there was Kornblut's department store, which sold more high-end goods than Cohen's did. We had Epstein's furniture store, which I think Harold was called Ideal Furniture, right? And that was next door to Cohen's. And then at one point in time, the Epstein family decided to open up a business that was preppy clothes when those came into popularity. And there was Blum's, Cohen's, Kornblut's, Epstein's Furniture, and the Village Square. And there was a gas station.
All of this in Latta, which is...
All of this on Main Street in Latta.
What's the population of Latta?
1,500 at the time. Okay.
Question back there.
And also, Cotton City Wash Box, which was Hartsville, which would which did Hartsville, or was in Hartsville, Winsboro, and Bishopville. And that's what brought us all down. My sister and brother-in-law, the Brenners, Harriet and Bob Brenner, Murray and myself, Tom Grossman and Kirsten were involved in that. Al Wheeler, I don't know if anybody remembers Al Wheeler and his wife Jackie. I mean, those were tremendous. And, of course, they all just closed their doors within the past 10 years.
Let's go to, rather than to the social life right now, and speak a little bit about what the future might have been for these businesses if things were different. Why did the businesses close? Briefly.
Heritage Sportswear, like I mentioned. What if they didn't close, or why did they close? You could, like I said, you could blame it on current events, which was 9/11, when in September when 9/11 happened in New York. That was the height of the selling season for the following two seasons, and everything stopped. Little stores decided not to purchase, sell their inventory. Major department stores were afraid to bring a lot of people in, that they might be targeted. And business just fell off for about a year and a half. And believe it or not, I had suppliers that really did want to get paid. They didn't want to wait a year and a half. And the merchandise that was coming in from China.
I think I'm hearing two different reasons for the lapse of these businesses. On the one hand, there's the manufacturing businesses that the demise had to do with world events.
Correct.
And the retail side was probably very different. It had little to do with world events. What did it have to do with?
No.
Okay.
It had plenty to do with world events. Donna Cohen. Yes.
TJ Maxx. That's why y'all went out of business?
No, TJ Maxx was not on the horizon at that point in time. What was is Walmart. Right. So there was no way to compete when you were buying as a resident, through a resident buyer in New York for one store and then several stores that my grandfather's brothers owned too. You weren't buying any volume, so you didn't have any price competition. The only thing that we had was that reputation for offering credit. So that was in lieu of lower prices, but you just can't compete with the level of Walmart, which is the story today of many small businesses. And as soon as people realized they could drive to Florence to buy more things than we offered at better prices and buy more variety, that is eventually what I believe spelled the doom. And, you know, it was just hard to make a living doing that.
Also, you might remember that store credit became less important than the credit card.
Exactly.
Not necessary to have store credit, then that unlocked the customer.
It did. Although many of our customers were never able to get a credit card, but for the population in general, that's absolutely true.
Richard, do you have anything to add to that?
My parents sold low-priced clothing, but we didn't feel quite the same competition from Walmart and other discounters as some other stores, because my parents managed to find stylish items and focus on those, and they could turn on a dime and buy something that was coming out right now and get it in the store in a week. But it meant that they needed to be really good at what they were doing, and my father and my mother were really good at buying, and they specialized in different things. But I looked at them in awe. I mean, I knew I couldn't do that kind of thing. I wasn't really that interested in taking it over anyway. But if they had tried to sell underwear and sock and plain socks and that sort of thing, they would have failed and very quickly. So, of course, they were facing more competition for more and more of their items, but they still had this niche that they had special talents to make work, but it depended very heavily on those individuals with the talents. And when they were gone, it was gone.
I would agree completely with what you're saying, because there's a big market for hats, Easter hats, things like that, that you just had to have in a small town store.
Manufacturing to come back like it was, if in fact they bring everything back from China back into the United States?
I don't think you could ever bring everything back to the United States, but let me just, I got to say it, small manufacturing that uses, should I say, unskilled labor, it's a dead industry in this country. And I don't care what communities are going to do in terms of incentives to get you to start a manufacturing plant, you cannot compete with the cost of labor. When I was a young fellow and we went to China and we were buying light bulbs and importing them, and I went into a factory where kids 12, 13-year-olds were working in the factory. They were sitting there dipping light bulbs into a rubber coating machine and drying it out. We had to spend over $200,000 in Mullins to comply with local and state and federal requirements to do the same operation. And we had machinery that did that, that dipped the bulbs into the rubberized coating. Well, you can't compete. It's impossible. And this was 20-odd years ago. So I hate to say it, because I know how hard small communities are trying to entice business, but you're not going to get a small manufacturing company to come into a community and start up a facility when you got to pay the wages you got to pay today. And believe me, the people earn those wages. I'm not saying don't pay them, but you can't compete with the likes of China and the other offshore countries. Reality of it. Well, the only thing that I can think of, I mean, they all have ideas, but unless the tax codes are drastically changed and they take a lot of taxing away from domestic manufacturing companies, small businesses, maybe those companies can start and be more competitive, but it just doesn't seem possible.
Or put a carbon tax so the things are not sent out of the country as part of back to the country as part of the country. If you've got a carbon tax, if you're paying all of the real true cost of moving things back and forth,
well, I hope that whoever leads us forward, and I have my gut feeling about this is not a political thing, but if we get some change, maybe we can help the small businesses, and I hope that there are some opportunities and new ideas to put forward.
I think we have a question in the back.
Question.
I'm probably the oldest person here, but I grew up with my father's family, my grandfather, Abraham Schaefer. You're talking about old stores. Abraham Schaefer came to Timminsville, whose brothers were in business years ago. The Schaefer Company in Little Rock was older than any of these, because my grandfather gave Harold's grand, your grandfather.
Grandmother.
Oh, he had daughters. So every son that got married got a store. One was Latta, one was Dillon, and the Roland store, but it was two in Dillon. Blums. He came from Germany as a younger brother of people in Timminsville. This lady over there said there had never been Jews in Timminsville. They had stores there, the Schaefers, years ago. In Little Rock, would still be there, except the Hamas owned the property. There was no Dillon. And they wanted to build the railroad, the Atlantic coastline, and Mr. Hamer would not give the land, wouldn't let him sell it. So Dillon gave the land, which is a swamp. That's why we have floods there. In the meantime, Abraham Schaefer's store was in 1800s, and his bride came from Darlington, by the way. So we go way back, and then, like we will be talking about Alan. Alan was a young kid, and the train came connecting Hamlet to Dillon or somewhere, and he got ice cream as a kid to sell on the street, and they would drop it off. He had the idea to sell, and that's why he put the same ice cream at the border many years later. But the Schaefers and the Blums and the Kornbluts were children of my grandfather. And as far as giving credit, Donna, I remember as a kid the Depression, and they had buggies coming up every Saturday, and they gave all credit to the farm people. That's why everybody went bankrupt in 32, because they couldn't, the banks failed. So I kind of remember that.
Thank you. I want to move over now to raising a family and growing up in the PD. And I want to ask specifically if any of you have anecdotes that you might want to share about going to school in the Bible Belt, either yourselves or your children. Were there any special problems, any special situations that you care to share? What?
A funny one. When I was in public schools, I went to public schools until college, we were always facing the problem of high holidays. And they had something called 6 weeks tests. Every 6 weeks, we were tested in all our subjects. And it came around the time of high holidays some years. Particularly, I guess, if the high holidays were a little later than they might be. And so one year, the Jewish community went to the school system and complained about it and asked them not to schedule the 6 weeks test on our holidays. Wasn't, and so the order went down, or the memo went down, and that year I had all six scheduled on the high holidays, and we asked the teachers why, and they said, well, we heard that they weren't going to be scheduled then, so we figured we would be the only one, and it would be really nice for everybody else. So I don't think they meant anything bad by it. They just saw it as a great opportunity to have one. They would be the only ones in the whole school having the test that day. So it was an indication where sometimes making a fuss can make things worse. But I guess overall, though, I mean, the real point of the issue is I may have been completely oblivious to it, but I didn't see prejudice or difficulties between in the schools between Christians and Jews, and they knew we were Jewish, and I didn't get negative comments. I'd be interested to hear if others did, because you all grew up in the same kind of systems.
Rick, Bruce,
I was at Marion High School. Here I go. 1955 to 58 or so, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th grade, and I had no problem. The only funny anecdote was when we moved down, my father moved from Mississippi, and we still had a house in Brooklyn, so my mother brought us down from Brooklyn, so when I walked in 7th grade, I was introduced as someone coming from Brooklyn. And I had my first friend come over, shake my hand, and he said, do you know so-and-so? I said, what? And he named about four or five people. He said, they're from Brooklyn. They're in the Brooklyn Dodgers. Don't you know them? I said, no.
And he couldn't get over that I didn't know everybody in Brooklyn, because he knew like everybody in Marion. When I explained to him at that time that Macy's department store had 7,000 employees, which were more than the people in Marion, he said, impossible, there's no store that big. And the only other thing I was telling, we're talking about northern food and whatnot, and I was explaining to them what pizza was. They didn't have pizza down here. And they couldn't believe somebody would eat a piece of bread that's round with tomatoes and other stuff on it. They said, nobody's going to eat that. If I was smart, I would have started the first pizza restaurant down here.
Bruce.
I did that.
I didn't have the good fortune of being able to go to school in South Carolina. I'm a graduate at New York University, and I enjoyed a lot of wonderful times up there. However, my firstborn son was raised here in Florence, South Carolina, and I'm super proud of the fact that between my son Adam, myself, and my father before him, I think we might be one of the only three generations of Siegels that have served as presidents of the congregation here in Florence. And what really intrigues me is that I was having dinner, my wife and I were having dinner with our grandson, Arthur Rabin Siegel, the fourth generation here. And we asked Arthur what he wanted to be when he grew up. And he says, well, I'm going to be the first Jewish president. And my wife asked if she can spend the night in the Lincoln bedroom, and he said, no problem. So I think that as long as we can see our children have a desire to stay within the community and raise their families here, and the temple continues to be a focal point in everybody's mind, we can see the Jewish traditions and heritage continue on for years to come. And I certainly hope that's the way it is. I hope I'm around long enough to see my grandson and my granddaughter and my other five other grandchildren go through bar and bat mitzvah. So that would be wonderful. But I'm excited about the opportunities here in Florence.
Thank you, Bruce.
In our family, my mother was from Baltimore, which meant that she was a Yankee, which was worse than being Jewish. And so... what? No, in Latta, that was definitely considered to be Yankee territory. Right. But I felt like we grew up in a nurturing environment, and we knew that we were different. We knew that we didn't go to MYF on Sunday nights, but it was okay. And for the most part, I felt very much accepted in the community. It was just an okay thing. There were isolated incidents, but I think in everyone's youth, they're going to have situations where they were made to feel uncomfortable.
Thank you, Donna. Mm-hmm. Let's move on to a slightly different topic and consider Jewish life in the PD. And the trend, as I see it at least, seems to be over the decades to be from more observant and more traditional to less observant, less traditional. And I just wonder if there's any evidence in your families that this trend is reversing. And there's at least a standstill where we're not going even less and less traditional. We're at least staying where we are, or perhaps we're going more traditional. For example, is Yiddish still spoken any place in your families? And if not, when was the last time it was used?
Whenever my mother and father didn't want me to know what they were saying. So you don't need to know when I would say, what is that? You don't worry yeah. about it.
Does anybody speak Yiddish in this room?
I can understand it. Mr. Klumbluth.
Yeah, I would disagree with your premise that we are less traditional, that we're going less traditional. I would say, at least ritually in this congregation, we are far more traditional than we were 25 years ago.
And I noticed that last night when I was in services.
There was,
yeah.
I mean, I grew up in a conservative congregation in Dillon and came over here for a youth group. Was bar mitzvahed by Rabbi Lesser and met in that office right over there for my bar mitzvah lessons. And this congregation ritually is far more traditional, far more observant than I think it was 30 years ago.
And I
can recall a conversation, I believe it was with... Kagan, Bonnie Kagan, that made a convert that told me one time that when the religious school was started, maybe it was Pat Siegel. Pat might be able to tell us on that. But that when the religious school first started, they were first starting to do a religious school here. The parents didn't know how to start religious school, so someone suggested that they do it. They'll start with the Lord's Prayer. Well, yep. That's not a particularly appropriate start for a Jewish religious school starting. From Timmonsville came and started Heimlich. Bernice Heimlich from Timmonsville came and started raising Cain about it because she didn't. That wasn't appropriate. We don't start Jewish religious school with the Lord's Prayer, this was very reform. Even if you look at the prayer book that was used in 1950, the little small one, versus what we use now for the Mishkan Tefillah, this is a much more traditional congregation than it was 30, 40 years ago, and therefore the members that are here are in effect practicing more ritual than we were. I mean, we have an operating Hevra Kedisha. Never had that 30 years ago. Donna Sue is the head of that committee.
Right.
We've got some traditional attributes that we're using here that we didn't have.
You're saying that the trend has already reversed.
It has been reversed. It's been reversed in the last 20 years.
And where do you think it's going?
I think that those of us that are believers believe.
Where's this congregation going?
Well, we're not too prolific, but I mean, we're here. Most of us are, we're not having any more children because we're older. And unless we have some more people move in, we don't have a lot of young kids in the congregation, but we're trying. We're trying to encourage those of us that the seagulls are trying to make up.
Okay. Does anybody have anything to add about Jewish life?
We got one back here. And the reason why we're carrying the mic around is not just, in all transparency, it's not just so everybody can hear you, but also Dale is recording some of this so that she can transcribe it later. So you let me bring it over to you, and that way she can make sure her notes are accurate.
Along with what Harold said, as far as our congregation goes, do you think, like this is to the panelists, do you think that the traditional sense that he's talking about has a lot to do with the fact that the children that we do have come in like the same age group, so as they grow up, they come and they move out at the same time, so they don't really have an opportunity to really contribute back to our congregation itself?
That's a question for the panelists. The question is, when the children grow up and move out, they leave the congregation in a sense and therefore don't contribute to the trend towards more ritual and more tradition. Is that true?
toward bringing in new ideas to kind of change the route that the congregation is taking.
I think that can really happen in the small communities, but I think you have a vibrant community here in Florence, and you know, as a past president, we always used to stand up on the holidays, and the president would make a pitch to get funds for the temple, and this congregation continues to be supportive. You've listened to stories about Timminsville and Dillon and other communities that have fallen by the wayside with their congregations. So as long as the community and the participants in this community will support this congregation, I think that leadership will come on from within the congregation's members that will continue to promote Jewish activities and provide a good opportunity for young people to come into. Most of the folks that leave the community go away because there's no jobs to come back to. I think Florence has opportunities. They got wonderful medical facilities here. They got colleges. There's opportunities for young people to come back to. In Marion County, where we had manufacturing, there's nothing. It's 19.5% unemployment in that county right now, highest in the state. You go around the county, and every building that used to have manufacturing is empty. It's a sad state. And the local government talks about building a building to attract industry. I haven't the slightest clue who's going to come into a community where you can't put people to work. I mean, you run drug tests and you'd eliminate 90% of those people that are applying for jobs in those communities. And it's just terrible. It really is.
Let me have that. Just to give you an idea about the Florence congregation, I've been here probably since 1952. When we moved in, at the house, one Friday night about 5 o'clock, we had Dr. Finger come over to get my father to come join the temple in Florence. That was the day they were going to vote on something, but you couldn't vote unless you were a member, a paid member. So he says, get your check. Come on, you're going to join the temple today. Okay. He comes over here. It was in 1952. There's a little table right here on the side here. He goes over, gives the check. They get information. And thank you for joining. And there must have been 8 or 10, 20 guys in there. They started a meeting. As it was getting hotter and hotter, guys were getting up, walking over the table, grabbing their checks, tearing them up, and walking out. Ooh. And my father said, what is going on? But they all came back, gave checks and everything settled. But this is back in the early days. There was a group, if it was 20 or 30 or whatever. Everyone had their ideas of how to run a temple. They were mad at first, but they got together, and we have gone forward over the years. What? No, there was no fighting. There was a lot of arguing, a lot of language, but it's something that happened, and it went on. But my father came back home, and he was telling my mother, and I was a kid, I was 14 then, listening to what was going on, and couldn't believe it. Well, that's just a little thing that happened here in Florence.
We have about 25 minutes left for this session, and I want to change this. 5 minutes? I thought we'd go till 3:30. Oh, the other one. Oh, we got 5 minutes. Quick question. Your legacy. Suppose we were to compile a book entitled The Oral Jewish History of the PD Region in South Carolina. 1 minute each. What would you like to include in that book? Anybody? Don't ask me.
I'm just from Hartsville. Yeah. I would like to see, I think it was most unique for my grandfather, a Jewish guy, coming out of Poland in 1905, coming to this country, couldn't speak English, and how he was able to build a business, and his two sons were able to grow it to become very successful, move it to South Carolina. I think there needs to be a documented history of how that transpired, and so that people coming into this PD area years and years from now can read about what happened in Mullins, South Carolina. I think it's fascinating.
I think Bruce just volunteered to edit that volume. Richard, would you like to? 30 seconds each. We don't have much time.
I guess the gist for us would be that my father was able to start a business from very little after the war in a place that was so different from what he had seen in the war, and was able to create a kind of the life that didn't involve the terrible things that had happened, and was something good for the community, good for the family, good for this congregation. It's the way it's supposed to work.
And Don is next, and Rick will have the last word. You had the first word, more or less.
I would just like to concur with what Bruce was saying. My grandfather came to this country when he was 15 years old. When I think about what my son was capable of doing in levels of maturity at 15 years old, it was not to get on a freighter and travel from Russia to the United States and then figure out how to feed himself when he got here. And that level of bravery and just the magnitude of that is just astonishing to me.
Okay.
Rick?
My fast 30 seconds. I think in this new history book, it's showing that a Jewish person could come from another part of the country to the Marion area, start a business, get a local person by a handshake to invest his money into fixing a building while this Jewish guy leaves to get the equipment, all for on faith. I don't think in Marion there was any anti-Semitism going on at that time. I don't think it's going on now. And I know the Levy family is well-liked, and today, almost every day, somebody comes up and says, my uncle or my mother's sister or whatnot had worked at the plant. And if it wasn't for that plant, I would not be here today because it paid for my education.
Comment in the back? Two comments. And then I'm going to cut it off and to make a closing statement. Go.
1982, but I don't think you guys are patting each other on the back well enough. I believe the little theater in this town was started by Jews. I believe that the support for the early support for the symphony and the symphony presidents, the community concert series was started by the Jewish families. As you saw from Alex's presentation, Jews have been mayors. It didn't just happen in the big cities like Greenville and Charleston. In this area, the Jewish merchants were very well respected. They were almost all on their city councils. They were mayors. And in the medical community, they were leaders in bringing new ideas and supportive of modern medicine. So I think that the whole spectrum of the cultural realm and the social realm and helping with to correct social injustice. I know the people that I met when I moved here. I can't tell you about all of their forebears who I knew. They were very welcoming people. They made our lives absolutely a pleasure. And when I look around the pews, I still feel their presence here. And I think that the mayor summed it all up. He was only talking about Florence, but the fact that all of your ancestors came here made a huge difference to the growth of these communities.
One more comment, one last comment. Go on.
So what you're talking about is leadership. And that's what all of these people you're describing differentiate themselves from everybody else. Now, I don't know if many people here know about the Fugu Plan. You knew that the Japanese tried to import Jews during the early part of World War II to Manchuria. And the reason they wanted to do that is because everybody knew that a Jewish cup was very capable of doing something, and this was leadership. And you said something. 15 years old when your great-grandfather came here, my son at 15, he didn't even know what side of the bread to butter on. That's what you said, okay? But you grow up fast when there's a necessity. I have to tell you, it's Rick Levy, I guess, who said that, and very impressed with Bruce Siegel's story as a manufacturer. If I just think what you're saying, this is 2012, and everything you're talking about in terms of what we're listening in the political arena now, you are talking about, you know? But your relatives took a chance, and they did it, okay? And I think we could do it again.
As just one concluding remark, and then you can talk afterwards. Oh, wait, with this. All right, we'll keep going. Just go on.
And speaking of new, well, I think I'm probably the newest. I've only been here 2 years. By the way, my name is Bill Galindo. And the one thing that needs to be understood, I believe, and we probably do understand, that aside from the history of the Jew here in the South, well, it's throughout, not just necessarily this here in the South, but throughout the nation, throughout the world, throughout many times and eras, it's been the same thing. We have a common thing, which outside from the ebb and flow of the religious aspect and culture and whatnot, everywhere as we go, we have the same concerns. And that's what makes the richness of who we are and what we are when we stand for. And aside from just the individual, is everyone that has been before us and those that are going to continue in our footsteps being Jews. It's the understanding of what we stand for, what we are, and where we're going, and what we've come from that has made us who we are. And regardless what where you're at, which congregation you're a part of, or what is the trend at the time, is that richness that here has been presented, that has been almost everywhere, that wherever you've come from, whether it be the Southwest from where I'm from to being here now. And there's that connection. And that's the one thing that makes us who we are.
And you just heard the penultimate comment. The last comment goes to this lady right here.
I'd like to make a comment because I tell you, I'm from Charleston, South Carolina, and I've enjoyed listening to the panel so much because everything is so different. I never heard of
it. For the microphone.
I never heard of the PD. We were in the low country. I know that on Sunday mornings that the merchants would come in from all around the little countries to come into Charleston to buy their wares and everything. But to get back to what he said about his grandfather coming, didn't know how to speak English, didn't know how to write, nothing, okay. My grandfather came here, he didn't know how to read, didn't know how to write. And the only thing he could do, he went into the shul and he became a shamus. He wanted to become a shamus. They were looking for a shamus. So the president came over to my grandfather and he's talking Yiddish to him. And he asked him, he said, I want you to sign your name here and you've got a job. And my grandfather told him, I can't read, I can't write. He said, if you can't read and can't write, you don't have a job here because people come in, they pay money, you've got to give them a receipt. So he went out. Just like your grandfather, my grandfather became very, very, a big businessman, and he did very well for himself. And his little grandson came and asked him, Zadie, how did you do it? You couldn't read, you couldn't write. How did you become such a big businessman? So the Zadie said, Tatala, if I could read and write, I'd still be a shamus in the big shul.
Folks, I think we see that the interactions between the Jewish community and the larger PD community has been mutually beneficial and maybe worthy of being organized into, the history being organized into some sort of oral history publication to include, I might add, any correspondences that you might have that are worth archiving. And I'd ask the folks here on the panel and in the audience to think about undertaking such a project. Thank you.
Thank you.